Hey, this is Devin Boker, and you are listening to The Wildlife. Today, a conversation with someone that I've admired for a very long time. Actually, we sat down to record this past July. Ah, okay. Whew, it's working. All right. Okay. Let me close up Zoom quick. Had a little trouble getting started, but we got there.
Hi, everybody.
The Queen of the Wild. Army veteran, wildlife tech, and one of the most passionate human beings I've ever had the pleasure of speaking with. Our conversation covers a lot of ground, becoming a wildlife tech, woodpeckers, federal jobs, the friction of private land, SCICOM and education, battles, big and small, and above all else, love for the world around us. A heads up, we do dive into some deep territory on this episode, topics around sexual harassment, discrimination, racism, among other things.
I am currently located in Goodyear, Arizona, but you might recognize me from working on the Angelina Sabine National Forest in East Texas.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, like you said, a lot of people recognize you from social media and the work that you did with the Forest Service and lots of bird pictures and bird content and stuff, which is always good. Always love that stuff. But like, you know, that's how people recognize you now. I mean, what kind of got you to that point? What was your educational experience like?
So I'm not sure how many people know, but I am originally a veteran, and I was I stayed within the field I was in for quite some years. And when I was in the Army, I used to make a lot of jokes about being a veterinarian, and my friends would get me like all kinds of books about very like soft feminine characters that wanted to be veterinarians and stuff. And when I got out of the Army and I was done kind of with my military career, I really wanted to be a veterinarian. I originally wanted to like open a dog rescue for like elderly dogs where they could go and pass in peace was like my original plan. And I was going to be this veterinarian. But Arizona State University, they require that you do a internship before you graduate within your field. I don't know if it's all medical fields, but I know at least for veterinary sciences it was. And I had started to notice like the difference between me and the other people who were like absolutely gonna be veterinarians, you know, and like they were always doing stuff with like different animals, but not wildlife, like cows, dogs, cats, like, you know, they were always doing all these different kinds of things. And I was kind of slacking on getting out there. I just didn't feel like stirred up in veterinary sciences.
So she found an internship with Dr. Heather Bateman at ASU.
And I just applied. I was like, I want to know if working with animals is what I really want to actually do. And before I even had interviewed for that job, some of the classes I was taking, mammalogy, wildlife ecology, they were part of the veterinary science program. But they kind of like, once you took those, there was like this weird kind of split because ASU hadn't figured that part out yet. So sure, a lot of the animal classes were crossover, because if you're a veterinarian, the only time you got to have like that animal contact was when you took like the wildlife biology, wildlife ecology classes. So again, I applied for that internship and I started reaching out to my professors, and I was like, I'm really wanting to work with animals. I'm losing interest, so I'm trying to get into something quick. I want to know if this is what I want to do. And everybody pointed me towards Heather, and I applied, I interviewed, I did some research on the position, what her research project was about, which was a salt cedar invasion. It's tamarisk is the scientific name, and pretty much it had been in Arizona for quite some time, and we were using the biocontrol beetle to lessen its impact on our environment, on our biome. But there was other responses because willow flycatchers.
It's a kind of bird, small, short, sharp beak, olive in color with pastel yellow and buff brown accents, and a white throat. Adorable.
had adapted to using other trees when we released the biocontrol beetle. So we were studying, like, what exactly were the impacts of the biocontrol beetle once you let it out? Was it as beneficial as we think it is? What was it doing to the microdiversity? And we were using frogs, snakes, lizards, toads to measure that. Herpetofauna, excuse me, to measure that. So I got involved with this project, and at first it was incredibly scary because I went from puppies and kittens and dogs to snakes and roaches.
It's a big jump. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, it was, at first I was scared for myself, but then mm-hmm. I realized that I was falling in love with the adventure. I get being a veterinarian is not the same every day, but once you get right. a little bit more involved into that career, you know if you want that for you or not. And I think I had already known that it wasn't right.
I think that's maybe not like a super common, but it's definitely like a story that I've heard. There's like a lot of people who, you know, you have a fondness for animals and things, and maybe you just haven't been exposed to it or haven't known about it. Like certainly for me, like when I started my educational experience, I originally was going for history education.
Oh, wow.
And then I don't know, I was taking generals and I was in a biology class and I was like, oh, you know what? I think I want to kind of do something more here. So I added a few more courses in that. Yeah. And then all of a sudden I'm like in wildlife and I'm like, no, okay, this was it. And I've talked to a number of people who were like, yeah, I went to be a vet, but then the domestic animals weren't really kind of my thing or my energy. And it was more the wild stuff. And then boom, all of a sudden they're in wildlife biology or a wildlife technician.
Yeah. I feel like the science is a little bit more, different. Yes. But the science is more impactful. I feel like it's more of a tangible, not to, you know, not knocking on veterinary sciences. It's just a very different kind of experience when you're out there. Because the days that you get what we called it skunked, you know, when you got nothing in any of your traps, you know, you have no idea what could have possibly changed. You've been checking these traps every day for like the last 7 days. Because, you know, we were doing 10 days on, 4 days off. So, you know, you're out there for 10 days and it's day 7 and you've been slammed with herps. There's just every kind of whatever you could imagine. And then all of a sudden, nothing. And it's just crustaceans and crickets. And you don't know until the end. It's kind of like every day is a different chapter. And once you put all your data together at the end, then you can kind of start to look at these different things that could have had an effect on why you didn't see something one day or the other. It's a very different kind of vibe that I don't think, because it's so, people love it. So it's so tender, so precious, but also very hard to get into. People don't talk about it a lot. So like when you're a child, you're like, oh, I want to be a veterinarian. But no one says, like, have you considered being a wildlife biologist?
One of the things I love about just the wildlife field in general is, I mean, it's so, in terms of, like, the things that you can study or do or work on, I mean, it's pretty much endless, you know? It's not like you're tied to one specific thing. You can be a generalist, or you can focus, you know, you can focus in really intensely on one thing. Or you can go anywhere, and that's kind of awesome.
That's what happened. That's how I ended up with birds. I'm sure everybody knows by now. I'm hoping they do if they're listening to us talk. But you know, there's a tight connection between, you know, herpetofauna and ornithology, and you know, depending on what you subscribe in and everything else. But that connection goes very far back. So, because I'm a veteran, I went through the USA jobs process. I actually had been preparing myself for a good year or two to get into the Pathways program. And the forest that took me on was working on birds. And when you're a wildlife biologist, yes, you do focus on, you know, your species of choice, but you also learn everything, right? Like, no one goes into this field and they're like only doing mammals. You have to know enough, at least. And so, you know, because I was just so happy to be in the field, creepy crawlies, you know, what is it? Lepi is what we use for like flighted, for birds, I think, or for, not for birds. What is lepi for? Scaled wings?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was like, close enough. Close enough. I'll take the birds and I'll figure it out from there. But yeah. It was just, I had to adjust, and I did get my chance to like work with some herps. We had the Louisiana pine snake that we were managing for, which was actually more endangered than the red cockaded woodpecker. Harder mm-hmm. to find, but you kind of know when you get out there what the species of concern is, like what they're focusing on.
Yeah.
What they're really wanting to work on. And the Louisiana pine snake out there just wasn't like the bigger species of concern. There was more focus on the red cockaded woodpecker. There was also an endangered toad that was out there too. I cannot remember the name of it, but it was named for the area in which it was found. But birds are very charismatic, and yeah. People tend to, you know, you don't see a lot of like dead birds that have been like run over by the general public. But if you think about snakes, frogs, and toads and stuff like that, yeah. People are more apt to run those over. So just, we ended up focusing on the birds. I didn't care because it was wildlife. I still got to interact with wildlife. I was still in the field, right? Just because I was working with birds doesn't mean all the herps went away. I just had to learn how to look down and up and down and yeah. up like most of us yeah. do, you know, because you yeah. learn plants, you learn everything that kind of your species depends on. So I just had to make the decision on what was more important, working for the federal government and being able to do all of these things or wanting to stick directly with herps. And I'm glad I opened myself up to both.
No, you bring up a good thing, by the way, when you talk about how people are more apt to kind of like run over, you know, snakes and herps and things like that. It's so true. And you know, I'm talking to someone tomorrow about like animal ethics and the way that people view different types of animals and things.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's kind of like, you know, people who are into wildlife don't necessarily like maybe see it that way. Cause like we see the beauty in a lot of different kinds of animals.
Yes.
But there is this kind of like broader, like, pretty privilege when it comes yes! to animals.
Yes.
You know? Yes. And it's like, oh, this is a really pretty bird, so it matters more. And it's like, yeah. Wow, okay. You know, there's a lot of other things going on here. Other animals.
Polar bears. You know, yes.
Yeah. It's kind of silly. You know, there's a lot of, if it's cuddly and if it's got big eyes, you know, yeah. People are like, love it.
Absolutely. Oh, it's so cute. And I'm like, oh, yeah. But it could also be dangerous, or it's not that beneficial. Yeah. So
right, yeah.
Before I got diagnosed with cancer, I was working on my master's, and one of the things I wanted to explain to people, especially in Arizona, I grew up here. So another thing that was very funny about working with herps in Arizona, they bring you from like grade school, they bring you all the dangerous snakes and tarantulas and scorpions to your schools, right? Like, don't touch this. And magical, mystical wildlife. As I've gotten older and I got involved in this field and just talking to a lot of my friends and family, the rattlesnake, identifications are high. Everyone knows what a rattlesnake looks like. Everyone's complaining about rattlesnakes. Arizona is rife with people who will come to your house and just move the rattlesnake for you somewhere else. I was wanting to study king snakes because I don't think a lot of people understand that that is a natural predator to rattlesnakes, copperheads, water moccasins, all of these venomous snakes. The king snake is there to eat and to kind of, you know, keep the population down, but it's also a big snake. It's a scary snake. So people run it over. And I just wanted to take this time to let you guys know. they'll keep the yeah. other snakes at bay. You know, I didn't get a chance to finish that, but
if I get yeah, a chance. You know, I can't, you know, you were based in Texas for a time. So, you know, I mean, like a huge part of Texas is privately owned. I mean, of like, yes. It's like 97%.
Yeah. Now that was definitely an interesting part of working with the Forest Service was, so there's a lot of, it's when you look at the Angelina Sabine, it's kind of like a mosaic. So you can see where those private lands are mixed into the yeah. public lands. And because of the way things are out there, the way they grow, it's very humid and it's mm-hmm. very, very hot. And so it's essentially a tropical environment. And yeah. you know, your plant life just, it just mm-hmm. goes crazy. And so one thing that we would have to do, so I was involved with a lot of prescribed burning. The tree that red-cockaded woodpeckers depended on was a longleaf pine. It goes through a stage, a grassy stage, where it won't hit the next stage unless you burn. I can't remember all of the details and technicalities behind it, but essentially if that grass stage doesn't hit, I don't know if it's a temperature or a release of certain like chemicals that happens when it's burning, but it burns in that grassy stage and essentially it'll shoot up from there into puberty, mm-hmm. hopefully getting the red heart fungus, which the red-cockaded woodpecker needs to cavitate its cavities. Cavitate, I think is the word, to dig in, yeah. excavate its cavities.
Excavate, yeah.
Yes. So it would dig in there to excavate its cavities. So I got really involved in that. If we did not burn enough, we would have to go in and install cavities for the birds. Mm-hmm. So usually if you were in wildlife, they're helping you out. So you kind of help them out. And that was something that I got involved with. Anyhow, we would have to knock on these doors and let people know like, hey, we're getting ready to burn. There's this endangered bird species. Or, hey, we're getting ready to burn. We used a helicopter to drop the ping pong balls. People thought those mm-hmm. were snake eggs, and we would have to go in and talk to people. I know that sounds crazy, but it's very true because they were white little yeah. balls. And like I uh-huh. said, there was an endangered snake species. And so they would think, the public would think whatever. And we, mm-hmm. as a Forest Service, would have to talk to them and let them know not only what we were doing, why we were doing it, and then what it was going to lead to. And that's yeah. kind of like part of the NEPA process, but
yeah,
it's yeah. very technical.
I can't, oh gosh, no, I know what you mean though. And sometimes, yeah, the things that the public kind of will come up with are just, I used to work in wolf conservation and
oh goodness, I can't even imagine.
I would, you know, I'd be talking with people, you know, like somewhere really far north, very rural, and you know, they would be like, the federal government is parachuting wolves onto my property. And I'm like they're jumping out of planes and like how exactly do you mean this? They're like, well, yeah. they weren't there and now they're on my property, and the only way they could have gotten there, and the government's trying to plant them there. And I'm like, okay. And then that was not helped by the fact that when they did the reintroduction on Isle Royale, they helicoptered them in to the no! island and they used parachutes. So I was like, no. Because then everyone, yeah, that became a thing. And they're, oh, gosh. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes it can be interesting.
It's interesting and frustrating at the same time.
Yeah.
Because you... Yeah. I have your attention, you're getting involved, but you're not looking into what it is that we're actually doing, you know, and now yeah. it's an old wives tale. And, you know, 10 years from now, you know, one time my granny's land, the Forest Service and the feds did this, and it ruins this relationship that you've been, you know, like trying to work on. There was yeah. this guy I used to work with. He was a private landowner. He used to do, we had a lot of feral hogs in East Texas. Terrible problem. And I was just telling him one time about the things we were getting ready to do. And some of his land butted up right up against this RCW cluster. And I was just talking to him about, you know, like, ha, 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 these birds don't care about lines. You know, they don't see that this is where Forest Service land ends. And I said, like, ha, 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 we're going to be knocking on your door to, like, you know, check on the RCW. And he totally changed. He was like, I don't have to let you in. I don't have. And I was like, I do want to, the Forest Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, we're not here to take your land. We don't want to take your land. We just want to provide for the wildlife that's on your land that you have, you know, you didn't ask for that. But people, like you said, the public will make their own things. And, you know, now we're encroaching on their property. It's a whole thing. It's a whole thing.
Yeah. And the idea of like land sovereignty and stuff is so
important
in our culture and stuff. Too, that, you know, it can, you know, especially in places like Texas where the landscape is so mosaiced with like private and stuff, it can make conservation really tricky.
Because
all of a sudden it's like, well, this is my land. I'm like, I know, but the species doesn't only live on it.
I don't want to take your land. I just want to look at
parcels. You just want to know where they are and stuff. And then some people will like refuse to even acknowledge that it's on their land. And then some people will kill anything that's on their land. And it's just, oh gosh.
And there's all these programs to help when endangered species do end up on your land. So that I thought was also interesting was how many people would deny that it was there, but the Texas, the state, the federal government will pay you like, you have a tree that this endangered bird's like. We will pay you to plant more of that tree. But in order to get to that point, I have to be there to record that. And it just sends the wrong message. So that part of the job is a little bit frustrating because the people who are really close to public lands, they vote, right? They know about the NEPA process. They've been doing it their whole lives. They go to the town halls. So not that they make it harder. That's not what I'm trying to get at. I just wish that our interactions were better so that when we were trying to make a positive change, they would be more apt to listen to it. Because like me, especially me showing up in East Texas, I'm not going to overrule three generations of this is what happened.
Yeah.
You know, but it's still fantastic. That's like the bad part of the job, you know, is like the people that we run into. Aside from that, the field time I had was amazing. But eventually I just hit a point where I needed to get my master's. That's just where I was at. I was a GS-7, so I came in through Pathways. I went 5, 6, 7. I was a 7 step 2, 7 step 3. And to get to a 9 or an 8, I needed to either get lucky and find another GS-8 position, which if anyone knows is not a popular number for a reason, or get my master's and become a GS-9. So while I was working out there, we had the, you know, whole 2020 COVID situation, and a lot of us were working from home. So what I would essentially do is work from home, write whatever reports, fill out whatever I was supposed to, and then go into the field and then come back home. So that part was a little bit of a bummer, but I did that. I re-enrolled in some classes, getting myself ready for my master's program. And then October, November of 2021, I got into NMSU as a master's student. When I was in Texas and I was going back to school and I was going back to classes, that is when I really started to, that's when my thesis started to develop a little bit more about king snakes. But I also started to notice that there is a communication problem in science. Mm-hmm. The way we communicated is so, it's not what we're saying is wrong. It's just off-putting to the people who we're talking to. It's like we're scientists are so used to talking to other scientists that when you talk to a member of the public, it's gone. And I really started to put that together because of the interactions I had with private landowners. I'd start getting specific about things and they didn't care about that. They wanted to know layman's terms, what is happening next to my land, what's happening on my land. And so when I started going to different places, I didn't mind how I was receiving the information, but I noticed that when I tried to tell my friends or my friends' kids, you know, oh, this is what I was talking about, I would be so scientific that no one cared. But if I said, actually, it's this really cool frog, like spadefoot toads. It digs underground and it doesn't come out till it rains. There's so much more to the spadefoot toad, but you're talking to a kid, you're talking to your mom, your dad, a member of the general public. They want to hear this toad is cool because it digs in the ground and it doesn't come out till it's rained. That's all they care about.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You know, I see that. I do. And I mean, I've had that experience myself too. I mean, even recently, like there's something about, you know, statistics and things too. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, in science, we all like, we have a bunch of numbers up our sleeves. There's all kinds of statistics out there that we like to talk about. And, you know, I posted a video not that long ago, something about shark decline. And just how rapid shark decline is. And I mentioned some of the statistics and I noticed, you know, most of the comments and things, like, people like got it, you know, but there's a lot of people who are like, okay. And like, why should I care? They're sharks, you know? And there's still like, there's that kind of element where like statistics don't quite speak, you know, they're not a story. There's no emotional appeal necessarily to that. You kind of have to rephrase it a little bit. And I think part of that is like what you said, it's like, people see scientists as being kind of elitist. They think that they're better than you. Yes. They already know everything. And like, no one wants to be talked to as a repository, you know. No one wants to be talked to as like, you know, I'm the expert and I'm telling you everything there is to know about the thing. Cause there's nothing for them in that.
Yes.
But if you can tell it more in something that kind of gets them curious, where they still have an opportunity to figure something out on their own or ask questions, then it's a whole different, you know, ball game. Like suddenly you've got some buy-in.
Absolutely.
That is absolutely, you know, an issue that I've seen as well.
Yeah. Cause when I look back, so ultimately now that, so we will get into the whole cancer thing whenever you want to, cause woo, what a doozy. My goodness. But what one thing that I have been thinking about since kind of all that came about, and because I have tons of time to watch and sit and read, is, and I get it. There's like the, I grew up with like, I'm sorry, that's Scooby.
It's okay. No worries.
With the Kratz brothers and like Steve Irwin, and it was this very generic version of what was happening out there. But I realize that people were like, oh, you know, oh, they weren't that educated or they didn't know enough. I don't think it was that. I think it was just the way that we receive information as not scientists. I don't know for certain, but just looking at how we communicate wildlife, even like, what is it? Our Planet Season 2. They talk about the calf is escaping this wolf and people are entrenched, right? Like they're so into it and they're rooting for whatever baby animal is running on their screen. But there's not a lot, we're not sitting there like, you know, this fawn is able to escape because of the, you know, carbon and the, all this that they're able to circulate through their muscles. We don't talk about any of that. We just communicate enough of what's happening out there. And so I don't want to dumb science down, but as I've been going through this process, I want to make it more communicative, like how you're doing. Ask me a question and I will do my best to give you an answer that you understand, not just.
Yeah. Yeah. It's gotta be, you have to have some kind of like, the person has to have some kind of moment where they can see themselves in it.
Yes. You know? Yes.
And like that experience or that, like it's some kind of universal need or mm-hmm. universal core concept or something. It's gotta be there. And I know what you mean. I've seen things even like talking about like Bill Nye and stuff where people would be like, well, Bill Nye is not a scientist. And blah,
blah, blah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, he's an aerospace engineer and he's part of the Planetary Society and stuff. He does know what he's talking about, but he can, if you know, like, yeah, maybe you now know more than you did when you were a kid who, watching Bill Nye.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that he was dumb or not communicating
yep.
all the stuff. It's the audience context, yes. right? Like,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I've just noticed, and that as I go through my career, that's one thing that I notice. And so that's, as I've been going through that process, that's kind of what has brought me to this point. So obviously now I have cancer and I cannot go in the field like I used to, which is heartbreaking. Trust me.
Yeah, I can imagine. And like I said, I saw, you know, you had a post somewhere, maybe it was like June, end of June. That's what I saw. Cause you had a bunch of stuff, like a bunch of regular stuff. And then it was sometime in January or so that things kind of started to fizzle a little bit. I was like, oh, I wonder. And then you had that update in June.
Yeah. So a lot of things happened over that time. So first of all, over that time when I stopped posting, the biggest thing that was happening to me was, unfortunately, and I don't know how much you're allowed to play because I know a lot of you have like students and stuff. But unfortunately, I was going through like some very bad racial, my civil rights were violated. Talking about private landowners, I was getting harassed by private landowners as well. So on the flip side of that, you know, me, Black woman, looking random, sounding not like anybody else from out there, they would get a little bit frustrated. They would get a little bit perturbed. Mm-hmm. And then in addition to that, I'm not giving them more stereotypical like responses. And I'd be working the deer check stations. And some of the comments that I just got were not great. So that was the first step in me like withdrawing, because I did kind of feel like I was posting lies by not talking about the like cruddier stuff that was happening. But because I was so in love with wildlife biology, it almost over, like, the cruddy stuff didn't matter because I was so in love.
I think that's an understandable, you know, that I get that. And even the person I was talking to a little bit earlier, I don't know if you know, what's her username on things? Biology Carly, Carly in York, she kind sounds of gives Miss Frizzle vibes. She's got like red hair and sits about this close to the camera and talks about
it. Yeah.
And it was a very similar thing. She was talking about how she, you know, like she has a lot of feelings about the environment and climate and stuff like that, you know, but like she is so afraid about posting anything negative or dark or.
Yeah.
You know, just because of how it might be perceived or if it might overshadow the other things. And I've had the same, you know, kind of like, gosh, am I doing a disservice by not talking more seriously and stuff about some of the bigger issues that I see in wildlife? And
you want to keep people involved. That's why I bring up that science communication, like, because you don't want to lose anyone because this field is already so hard.
Yeah. As it is. You don't want to like remove people's hope.
Yeah. That
they could be involved or welcome.
Yes.
And that's what you're talking about. It's a whole other layer that I have never had to deal with.
I can't
even imagine.
It was difficult to say the least. I thought I was going to get more support from my leadership because of the situation I was in. I tried really hard not to keep myself from going in the field, to keep, like, I never said, I don't feel comfortable going out there because it's just me. Yeah. I would just do it. Now, if something happened, I would come back. I would say, this happened to me today. I won't be going back there unless A, B, or C. Unfortunately, there's not very much that they can do about it. So I would get threatened. I would have people stop me. So if you, every, I don't know, I'm assuming everybody who's listening has been on Forest Service land, and there's FSRs, Forest Service Roads, and red-cockaded woodpeckers love the edge effect, oddly enough. They love a good edge. Get right up on it, and your roads will do the same thing, and sometimes you'll have a cluster that crosses, or sometimes you'll have two separate clusters because it still gives you that kind of effect. And I'd be walking along on my way to the next cluster, and it would be so difficult for people to understand that I was out there working. They would insist that I would get in the car with them. They would call my own, we called, not PO, EO, enforcement officers. And they, you know, they would call them on me, but that's my coworker. So it that part was interesting. The comments that people made were interesting, but it was actually more my coworkers that caused the problem than anything else. And so ultimately, so trigger warning for SH, but when I was on a fire detail, I was sexually harassed by somebody else's supervisor, and that was when I ultimately just kind of stopped posting. It was the racial stuff, it was the sexual harassment via text. I reported it, and the Forest Service asked me what I was wearing, and I was like, I'm on a fire detail, so green pants and a yellow shirt.
But I'm sorry, their question was, what were you like, as if it was your fault.
Yeah.
Which is so typical.
Yeah. Right?
But
yeah. And I again, horrible. I expected that to come. I did not know how to continue to post while all of those things were happening. And what I did not want to do was make anyone who was aspiring to work for the Forest Service or be in wildlife, I didn't want to, like you said, make them feel like this was some kind of dark field. I didn't want to do this field an injustice, because what I'm going through is different than what everybody else is going through. And I didn't want to paint it out to be like, this is what you're going to experience in the Forest Service. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want to sell any lies either. So I just stopped posting because I didn't know how to continue without doing one thing or the other. So that was originally what stopped my posting. Then I started going back to school, like I was saying, getting my master's, and I eventually left. I did take the Forest Service to court. We did settle out of court. I can send you the paperwork in case someone's like, I want to see. I do have the paperwork. It's public knowledge. I did have to take them to court for violating my civil rights. And from what I understand from my coworkers who are still there, they learned their lesson. They have long conversations about things that are and are not appropriate. I let the sexual harassment thing go because of the court issue. And they ended up firing that individual who sexually harassed me. Okay. So
at least there's that outcome. Yeah. You know, but like, hey, I appreciate, like, I know you're talking about how, like, you were worried about posting anything, and so you just kind of stopped because you weren't really sure what to communicate and couldn't really reconcile that with what were experiencing and stuff. I appreciate you talking about that here.
Like, yeah, it's actually really the first time I said that.
Yeah, no, I really, really appreciate it because, you know, I get that impulse. I really do, that, like, oh gosh, I don't want to deter people. I don't want to, like, paint a negative light. But those, you know, those are elements that people might deal with. You know, I worked for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for a stretch as a park ranger.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And, like, my partner, she was a young woman. She was kind of short and stuff. And yeah, people in the public, when we would go to the campgrounds, and she would come back up to the office in our Polaris.
Yeah, Rover, no, yeah, thing. Ranger, yeah, you're, yeah, right.
And she'd,
yeah,
be like, can you just come with me? Like, I don't, and I felt horrible all the time, because I'm like, that is ridiculous. I can go down there. Yeah. I can walk a loop. I can tell people to, you know, turn their music off. I can tell people that they can't be drinking in the campground and stuff. But then, like, she needs me to just be a presence with, it's ridiculous, you know? And
there was
comments from, like, peers that would happen. And then, like, I worked for the Minnesota DNR, and, like, I was below my superior, who was a woman, and the things that people would say to her compared to me.
Yes, yes. And I would take conservation groups out there. So I will say the Forest Service did a lot of work with Texas Conservation, TXCC, a lot of partnerships there.
Yeah.
And I would take them out with me, because another thing we have to do is keep the vegetation low for the RCW. So they'd come out there with me, and we'd be, you know, raking and getting fire prepping and all this other stuff. And if, even though I'd be all gussed up in my Forest Service uniform, or looking like, you know, obviously I had been there, and TXCC students or interns would have their t-shirts on, it was a very obvious difference. And they would still talk to the males in the TXCC group than they did me. And again, I'm sure this happens in all fields. I'm positive it does. Yeah. I just was, it, like you were saying, it's so hard to talk about the negatives when you're just so happy to be in it. Cause that is one thing people said. And I, right now I have cancer, so it makes it, you know, more and more true. I do miss my job. I miss the interactions I had with wildlife. I miss working for the Forest Service, but I don't miss some of the other stuff that came with it.
Yeah.
But there are
things that, like, yeah, people need to know. People need to know that those are things that can happen. They're possibilities. And the more that people know about that, the more that people can try to work to,
that's very true,
call it out and prevent it, and kind of weed that behavior out of those fields and make it clear that that is not acceptable and stuff. So, you know, like, it is so hard. It is hard.
And I noticed that, like, a lot of people were, I've never met a black woman who wanted to be a wildlife biologist before. And so, you know, there's all these questions. There's a lot that goes into, oh, why? But what I would try to do is be like, okay, instead of being like, well, how come you feel this? How come you feel that? And what did you think? And I would just be like, I'm gonna talk to you like any other wildlife biologist would. So when you see me or anyone who looks like me, you know you can do the exact same thing. You can approach them, ask them a question about wildlife. Because at least if there's anything I can say during that, like, low-key kind of negative time, was that when I was at the deer check stations, those people had to talk to me in person, right? So I'd be there cutting lymph nodes out, trying to talk to them about, you know, chronic wasting disease and all of that. And it would be me. And, you know, I'd be out there, and that, I think, made a difference. Some people would say, like, really random comments like, oh, you got raised up right or whatever. That stuff I would let go. Because I was just so happy that they had to have that interaction with me, and it, you know, challenged their viewpoints, and I just kind of let it go. But it was, that part was definitely interesting, but it has not deterred my love for the outdoors, birding, herpetology, anything. I love that now that I'm not in it, I can talk to my friends about it and get their kids involved. I can't go in the field like I did before, like hiking and, you know, because you have to seek out wildlife. It's not something. I will say that if you want to be a wildlife biologist, please, please, please start hiking now in the hardest conditions you can. I'm not trying to discourage anybody. Just get your physicality up because it is a very physical job. You have to hike to get to your wildlife. You have to, you know, like I said, I was checking, it's the terminology is leaving me, but I'm trying to think of the names of the traps I was using, pitfall traps. And we would have to hike for, I don't know how far in between traps to get out there. You can do it, but mm-hmm. do you love it? Are you passionate about it? Start getting that physicality up there now. Yeah. Up here, out here, it's hot, you know. I don't want to discourage anybody. I just want to let you know, like, if you want to do it, start looking into it now. Find, like, for me, there was a 100 course, and it was, like, wildlife biology 181, and we got a chance to test different kinds of trapping methods, different kinds of research methods, different ways that, you know, and you couldn't, because once you're in it, you're in it. Usually your instructors know what you want to work with. Right. I couldn't work with herps. They made me work with mammals. And that wasn't, I'd work with mice and rats. And everybody has a line. And mice and rats were my line. I still did it though. It was still 101% worth it. I ended up, it was like a little mini project that we did. And it was the moon phases actually were what was impacting what I was trapping. But it's, not having that physicality and not being able to go out in the field like I used to has allowed me to find a new way to communicate and a new way to show people science. So it's very funny. I'm talking to you. I'm getting my master's. I'm going to start again in August in STEM education. So I'm going to go into teaching.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
Yeah, hopefully I can move into a collegiate level and have a biology class like that where I just show people the different ways you can trap. You can get involved however you want to. Have people come into the classroom, talk to us about the research, what it's really like to be out there. Because that's another thing that I realized in that internship with Arizona State University, because there's U of A. I want to make sure I'm clear. Arizona State, ASU, Pitchforks. Okay. But there was a, it was a huge jump, but once I was in it, I was in it, and there was a lot of networking and figuring out who I wanted to work with, what it was I wanted to do. I suggest everyone get involved with an internship like that if you're wanting to be in wildlife biology in the field. Now, if you want to do something else, because I worked with some people, they were at the zoo. They started off at the zoo and they're still there. I know another person who started off at a Liberty Wildlife, it's a bird rehab here in Phoenix. And she is a contractor now that's also in Arizona. There's all these different things you can do in wildlife, but I just miss stomping through those grasses, running into that natural it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I cannot wait to be in a classroom and share all these experiences that I had and talk to people about the wonders of being outdoors and wildlife biology, the science that's there. You can measure impacts. You can watch something grow and measure that as well. There's all these different things to wildlife that's very, very cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know, like you said, you've been out of it and things, and I know part of it is the cancer. Which, I know that's absolutely a personal experience and things too. And so if you don't really want to, you know, share about that, I totally understand, but.
I'm down because awareness is key.
Yeah. And how, I know you like you had to cut back on outdoor activities and stuff, and I saw the thing about kayaking and you know, how are you doing?
Without wildlife, without my job, sorry, I might cry because I do.
It's okay.
This is the time for me. It's the time that I would normally be outside. I would normally be very involved with my job. I'm sorry. I'm looking out at the window right now.
Oh, it's okay. No, it's fine.
I'm doing okay. My health is good. I just, no one tells you when you become a wildlife biologist how much of that is in you, how much joy you get from your work. You're outside, which is already known to be good for you. I do get jealous of people who are able to just go and collect. But outside of that, I'm good. I just... I miss my job. Sorry. Yeah. I miss job.
Yeah.
I miss working with wildlife. I miss being outside. I miss all the things that are out there that people don't even know that are out there. I miss it all. Like how you feel when you complete a hike and you've checked all your traps and you have your sandwich and your Cliff Bar and your drink for the day.
Yeah.
I miss all of that, but yeah. I'm doing okay. It's just the waiting game. And I saw that you had your own cancer journey. It's just the waiting game for getting told that I can handle to go back out there again. So that's kind of, I think, why I'm also moving into teaching so that I can hopefully inspire someone the way I was inspired. And they can go out there and hike and herp and bird and all of the other stuff. But I'm okay. I just, I miss my job. I make a lot of posts about missing my job because I do. Because it's not just my job. Being a wildlife biologist isn't just like a job. It's a hobby. Right? Like you come home and you watch more of it and you look at other people's posts and you're like, wow, how can I see that? And you incorporate it into your vacations and it's
yeah, you do. Thing. You do. Yeah.
It's what you do. Yeah. You know? And so all of a sudden, like, I have this rule where I can't do it anymore. And of course, I'm a herper. So summertime is the worst time of year. Yeah, it's, I'm sorry I cried, but
no, it's totally fine.
It's, it's interesting to find a way to try to wildlife, which is why I took up kayaking. They were like, you know, your body just can't take that, but you can do other recreational activities. I would camp, but it's just me and that's not safe. So yes, that's how I got into kayaking. It's also why not like looking at fisheries like that, but wanting to look at, you know, when I'm kayaking, what's underneath and just trying to find other ways to connect with wildlife, that are not so hard on the body. I'm trying to find some nighttime herping spots, up by Lake Pleasant, which is a very popular laking spot out here. We have Saguaro Lake, which is part of the Salt River. It's part of the McDowell Mountains and a whole thing. So I'm going to try that. And if those things don't work, I'm going to call in a couple of favors and see if I can go to some old herping spots. Just to kind of feel that need. It's just hard because the things that I love are the most active right now when it's the hottest. So that part is hard, but my health is prevailing.
No, and you don't need to apologize about like having emotions about it. You know, it's totally no, I get it. And here's the thing, you know, you talk about hoping that like doing something in a teaching capacity or something that you can inspire that, you know, passion in other people. the people who can do that are the people who are passionate, and it is very obvious how passionate you are, you know? So I have no doubt in my mind that you're going to be excellent at that. And that you're going to be able to do that very passionately.
Thank you.
And I really hope that I don't hope, cause I know they will. Like, when people listen to this, when this is out there, they're going to hear that too. That's the kind of thing that people are drawn to and gets them inspired and gets them to want to explore those careers. And, you know, it's a whole world. It's a whole world. It really is. And it's like, it's a lifestyle, you know? And,
yes.
I think that you make that very clear and you articulate it very well and stuff. And I think people respond, like, they'll respond to that.
Thank you. Cause I get worried, you know, sometimes all the thoughts flood you and you're like, oh, where do I start with how much I love this? But I really do. It's especially like, so going through all that policy, right? Like, you learn all about it in classes and when was this law established and that law established, but then to actually like watch it play out. Right.
Yeah.
Somebody's, yeah. You know, like, I think, oh gosh, I hope this isn't too much. I hope I'm not, you know, like, ruining anything, but I believe we had an older recreation area, and someone had requested, like, hey, I've been coming out here for years. You know, my mm-hmm. granddad took me out here, my dad took me out here, I'm out here, I'm taking my kids, blah, blah, blah. And they said, but I would really love Wi-Fi. That's reasonable. That's reasonable, but enough people voted against the Wi-Fi. We didn't do it.
Yeah.
Now, if more people would have paid attention to that process, I'm sure, you know, it's just the whole thing mm-hmm. is, it's, I love the process. I love the whole, knowing the policies, why we started these policies.
Yeah.
The whole thing is great. The whole thing is great. It's just, yeah, I can't be in it like I used to it, but it's, if you're curious, if you want to get involved, I say do it. Even if no one knows what to call it, go for it. Because my parents did not. I will say that. Woman of color, my parents were like military, lawyer, doctor. Yeah, I think those were the options. I remember when I said, oh, I don't want to be a veterinarian, I want to be a wildlife biologist, and my parents are like, why? And I was like, what do you mean why? You know, it's yeah, but if you want to do it, I say go for it. Don't look at the posts. Don't look, we're all a part of so many Facebook groups and TikTok groups and everything mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
There is no way anyone thought I was going to get straight into a government job when I did. I mean, yes, I'm a veteran, but I mean, if mm-hmm. the rest of me just doesn't fit in with this field, and I still did it. So I definitely want to make sure that, like, if you're interested and you love it and you know you love it, and you may not know you love it now, you might find out in 10 years. I still say to go for it because it's well worth the peace and internal, I don't want to say pride, happiness, satisfaction. It's delayed. It's delayed satisfaction, y'all. Delayed satisfaction. But it is definitely worth
it. It's worth it.
Oh my gosh. I'm so glad that I did it. I'm so glad I did it. And there's more science in there than I thought would ever be incorporated in it, and I still love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't trade it for anything. So I do hope that passion shines through, but I do hope other students and children and even adults, because I was an adult. I was 30 whole years old when I graduated with my degree in wildlife biology.
In other words, it's never too late to chase curiosity and follow your heart. Thanks again, Lauren. It's rare that you get the privilege to speak with someone so passionate about what they do, and in a world of constant negativity and apathy, I appreciate your energy more than you know. You can follow Lauren on Instagram at lauren.queenofthewild and on TikTok at herp_trap_queen. Both of those links are also in the episode notes. And thank you for listening. If you'd like to support the show, you can do that for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/thewildlife. And with that, peace out, Rainbow Trout.